Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. There are about 200,000 American military personnel stationed around the world. They're in 130 countries. We'll discuss where they are and what missions they're pursuing. Joining us is Admiral James Stavridis, former NATO Supreme Allied Commander. He is now Dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Joining him is Richard Fontaine. He's president of the Center for a New American Security. Moderating the program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Ray Suarez.
Gentlemen, welcome to World Affairs. The United States military has been in combat nonstop for now almost 17 years since the weeks following the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And it's understandable. I think a lot of Americans remember that time, how frightened, how unsure of the near future we were. The President of the United States was given wide powers to make war around the world, to pursue people who might be threatening the United States. The reading, the interpretation of that authorization has often given presidents very, very broad authority. And I think now that it has been 17 years of almost nonstop war, people might be wondering how we get involved in the places we do, whether or not endpoints or understood objectives are put in place so that we actually sometimes leave places we go into. And if you showed an American a map of all the places the United States military is involved, I think they might be surprised. Admiral Stavridis, looking back to 2001, was it understood in the Pentagon that the United States military was going to be involved in a lot more places for a lot longer time than people might have realized?
Secretary Bob Gates, the best boss I ever had, often said that, you know, we're really good at predicting the next war. Our record is perfect in that we've never gotten it right. And I think that's correct. So the short answer to the question is, in 2001, nobody knew. A slightly more nuanced answer would be, and I'd be interested in Richard Fontaine's recollections, is that there was a sense, certainly on the military side, that we needed to be prepared for more. Because you'll recall, everyone was full of emotion after 9/11. We were talking not only about Afghanistan, but you could sort of see Iraq on the horizon in the conversations about the axis of evil. And so I think in the Pentagon, and I was in the Pentagon on 9/11, I was about 150 feet off the impact point on that side of the Pentagon. When we came in the next day, the building was full of smoke, and we started planning for Afghanistan. You could see on the horizon more conflict to come. So certainly in those days in the Pentagon, we had a feeling we were entering a long war.
Richard Fontaine?
I think that's right. And not only did the military and I think the White House and those who are making policy decisions not know geographically where the war would go, whether it was going to definitely go into Iraq once the Iraq preparations started up, Iran and Syria got quite nervous. You had the Axis of Evil speech and so forth, but also what these wars would look like. And it was not immediately clear, for example, that in Afghanistan, where the 9/11 plot was hatched and where bin Laden was holed up, whether the enemy would be al-Qaeda and we would let the Taliban stand, or whether we would topple the Taliban and try to turn over control of the country to an Afghan government immediately, or whether we would occupy the country in the way that we ended up doing in Iraq. And there was some hybrid that came out of that. But certainly, I think if you had stopped people and said, this is the beginning of a 17-year war in Afghanistan, and there will be theaters geographically distributed throughout the world, I think that would have been a surprise to people just trying to figure out how to react to this terrible attack.
Americans continue to die in Afghanistan, even this many years after the toppling of the Taliban government. Americans in recent months and years have continued to die in Syria and Iraq. And I think Americans are aware of our presence, at least dimly, in those places, our continued presence in those places. But back in February, when four U.S. soldiers died in Niger, I think a lot of people said, really? We have troops in Niger? I mean, in order to die in Niger, they have to be in Niger. And where's Niger anyway? Has there been, quietly, perhaps without the active engagement of the electorate, a broadening of the mandate in a way that perhaps Americans would be best advised to pay more attention to, Richard Fontaine?
The answer is yes, but I think the key Americans in this respect are members of Congress who have the oversight role as the representatives of that electorate. And there you see quite a difference than you did a decade ago or so ago when you had senators and representatives constantly going out to Iraq and Afghanistan to try to get a sense for how the war was going, offering alternative ideas, trying to point out when things weren't working. And so you have a decline in the number of folks who are doing that. When the Niger news broke, the reaction of many in Congress was outrage that this happened, sadness, of course, but also, wait, what? We're in Niger? And that is an indictment of Congress's oversight role. It should be much more carefully overseeing this war. And when I say this war, I mean these military operations wherever they take place.
Is anybody trying to put borders on these missions? Is anybody trying to put bumpers, limits, objectives, time frames? When I look at where the United States is currently militarily involved in the world and where some of the largest deployments continue to be, Japan and Germany are a legacy of World War II, South Korea of the Cold War and the Korean War, Italy of World War II and the need to watch the Mediterranean, Afghanistan, a legacy of the Afghan War. There are troops in places like Djibouti, which most Americans couldn't find on a map, but is home to one of the most critical seaports in all of East Africa. I just don't know if once we get to a place, we ever leave, or as part of the conversation, we talk about when it's time to leave. Richard Fontaine?
Well, we have left. In fact, we've left places pretty recently, and sometimes it doesn't go very well. So in 2011, when President Obama pulled all the remaining U.S. troops out of Iraq, it significantly reduced both any military influence we might have in that country, but also our political influence. And I think that was partly responsible for the rise of ISIS carving out the biggest terrorist sanctuary that has ever existed. And then, of course, we had to go back in, and now we have more troops in Iraq, arguably, than we would have had we left a residual force there. Similarly, in Afghanistan, the President Obama wanted to draw down troops to zero as the security situation actually was going backward rather than forward from our perspective. That looked increasingly unviable, and he ended up coming off of that deadline. So it's quite often easier to get into these operations in these places than it is to get out. And when you try to split the difference in places like Libya, doing your work from the air while not going on the ground, that doesn't seem to work all that better in some cases either. So there are some dilemmas, and you just can't always predict very well when you go into one of these operations where you're going to end up.
Admiral?
Let's kind of do the numbers for a minute here. Back in 2008, 2009, 2010, we had 500,000 U.S. troops between Iraq and Afghanistan. Today, we're down to 15,000. We were suffering, and I signed condolence letters to dozens of troops every month, occasionally over 100. Now, tragically, we lose one or two. So we can certainly get out of these places. The real question, and Richard Fontaine nailed it, is what's the right time to get out and under what circumstances? Ideally, what we want to do is get in there small, stay small, and help the situation get better. And I'll give you an example of that, Ray. It's Colombia. Colombia fought against a virulent insurgency for decades, the FARC, known for its initials in Spanish, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. And eventually, we developed Plan Colombia. We were capped by the Congress, having less than 1,000 troops there. We gave them a few billion dollars compared to hundreds of billions of dollars, approaching $1 trillion in Iraq and Afghanistan. That was small. We stayed small. We managed through it. Today, Juan Manuel Santos and the people of Colombia have delivered a peace accord. I think Colombia is going to make it. So there's a pretty good example of how this ought to work, as opposed to these massive footprints that I think are far less viable for us and lead, as Richard laid out quite accurately, to worse outcomes.
To the degree that Congress wants to be involved in the nuts and bolts of the creation of these operations, is there very little appetite in the post 9/11 world to be diligent about trying to stay small, to be specific about objectives, to ask hard questions about when we're done and what being done looks like?
Having spent 7 years of my life working in the Senate, I could see the diminishing political incentives for elected members of Congress to really dig deep into the wars we're in, particularly when those wars are so small that they're off the front pages and out of the minds of constituents. There's another more formal aspect to this, which is that if the CIA were to engage in a covert activity around the world, that would require a presidential finding. Let's say, for example, it was some paramilitary activity. That, by law, would then need to be briefed to the House and Senate intelligence committees. There's no corresponding legal requirement for the kinds of missions, these small missions that we're talking about. And yet, as the growth of special operations forces around the world have been employed in places, there's not the automaticity that you have on the intelligence side that exists on the military side. And so you have some of these operations briefed, some briefed before, some briefed during, some briefed once it's done to maintain operational security. And what it leaves is a Congress that is, both because of its own activities and this gap in the law, is less attuned and less overseeing the wars that we're in, these, especially these small-scale ones.
Well, when American forces are with national forces in these various places in the world, in Burkina Faso, in Niger, looking for Islamic State, looking in Somalia for al-Shabaab, looking in Cameroon or northern Nigeria for Boko Haram, do we have to be careful about mission creep? Anybody who's old enough to remember the Vietnam War perhaps knows that we never started out to be as deeply involved in Southeast Asia militarily as we were. And it started with training. It started with advisors. As the combat heated up, the arms that these advisors and trainers carried changed. The rules of engagement changed. What they were expected to do when they came under fire changed. And 3 to 5 years later, we were in a real live war. Admiral?
Sometimes it does happen and sometimes it doesn't happen. We mentioned Colombia before. I think that was both a congressional oversight piece, and also the military can be self-correcting on these things. And I think very much was in Colombia because we looked at the Colombians and felt reasonable level of capability, reasonably good partners. It was a good balance. Where it goes badly, Vietnam is kind of the classic example. But I would argue Afghanistan is probably an example of mission creep as well. It started off relatively small, and then we kept pushing, pushing, pushing. When I was Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, General Stan McChrystal came in, asked for a surge. We all remember Dave Petraeus asking for a surge in Iraq. There are generally good military reasons to do that. But politically, generally speaking, in my view, Ray, you're correct to point out the danger of mission creep. There are very few examples, I think, where we've had mission creep, where we then have a successful outcome.
I think part of the problem might be that we never go back to the people. We never go back to the rank-and-file citizens of the United States and say, hey, here's what we're up to. Here's what we're doing. Do we have you with us? A lot of the current missions around the world are being carried out under the authorization for the use of military force from when the World Trade Center was still smoking and people were visiting the ruins in Lower Manhattan. That was certainly a time for quick action, for national resolve, but we also have had 17 years to think things over, and I'm not sure that a resolution passed at a time of such national crisis was meant to last forever and cover a multitude of different missions. Richard Fontaine, have we asked that AUMF to do too many things, and are we doing too many things under its aegis?
Well, as a legal matter, we passed that point a long time ago when we, at a minimum, when our forces began to use the fight against ISIS, use that authorization to fight ISIS, which is a group that didn't exist on 9/11. So it's pretty hard to say that Congress authorized the use of force against a group that didn't exist when they actually debated and passed it. So there's a couple of problems, though. One, there's no near-term likelihood at all that there will be another AUMF. And if there were one, the only thing that could pass is one that would allow our forces to do tomorrow what they're doing today, which is to say, as a legal matter, it would be good government and so forth. But as a material matter, as a concrete matter, it wouldn't change the complexion of our deployments or our activities. And then there's a third problem, which is that there's a theory embedded in the AUMF, which is that the elected representatives will have an opportunity to sort of take the case to the people in advance of any use of force, that they'll have a robust debate about the costs, the risks, the merits, the demerits, and then they'll sort of put their heads together and either say yes or no. But in fact, if you look at the AUMF debates in Iraq in 2002, right after 9/11, the Gulf War, and so forth, these are not very good debates. It's not really – it doesn't prompt the sort of national conversation that we all seem to want. Instead, they tend to be rush jobs at the behest of an executive branch or, you know, a politically there's a lot of political pressure that comes into those things as well. And so we don't really have a good mechanism for having the kind of national level debate that you described.
Can I just add to that? Simply to say, first of all, I completely agree with Richard. And it also bespeaks, Ray and Richard, the civil military gap in the United States, which is that only about 1% of our population end up serving in the military. We have very few with military experience in the Congress relative to where we were in the post-World War II era, naturally enough, because it's an all-volunteer force. So we've found our way in the country to this marvelous all-volunteer concept and force, which I completely support, but it has had the effect of kind of distancing the military and therefore the civilian world, which is 99% of the United States, doesn't touch the military. Many don't know anybody in the military. And to be perfectly blunt, they don't really care about the military other than they support the military and they're patriotic, but they're not interested in the nuances in the debate. So I'll close by saying, Ray, that's why the media has an extremely important role here. And I really applaud your choice here to do this in a long form where we can unpackage this, and hopefully those kind of conversations will inform the civil side of this civil-military gap.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to World Affairs. That's Admiral James Stavridis, the retired Supreme Allied Commander for NATO, soon to join the Carlyle Group. He's also working on a new book on naval flag officers. And Richard Fontaine, the president of the Center for New American Security. Admiral, as a practical matter, as someone who spent your whole adult life, much of your adult life, in uniform, that civil-military gap, did you look across that chasm at times and think, wow, my job would be made easier, better, easier to understand, easier to explain, if the civilian world was paying a little bit more attention to what we're involved in, what we're doing, where in the world?
Absolutely. And the tragic irony is that the civilian side typically does not become engaged until the body bags are coming home. That's really what they care about in the end, because for all the obvious reasons. And then you have a superheated debate like we felt during the Iraq War. And that's the wrong time to be having that kind of debate. What would be vastly better would be an educated civilian population that appreciates the military but is willing to ask hard questions of their elected representatives so that we end up with efficient uses of our military that don't always reach instantly for hard power solutions. So often, to solve these challenges, we need a balance between a limited amount of hard power. We're not going to negotiate with the Islamic State, but often it's that soft power piece, education, finding new ways for populations to be employed, literacy training, medical diplomacy. You need that hard and soft power balance. That's a matter of educating the public. It's more efficient. That is what I've looked across that civil-military divide and hoped the public would support, was more efficient use of the military.
Richard Fontaine, let's talk more about that divide and also what the ideal would look like. If the United States has drones in the air over Yemen, over trackless parts of Somalia where there's no civil authority, over places in the world where the United States doesn't necessarily want to have people on the ground fighting in infantry action. Should we be in constant contact with the civilian world saying, look, this is what we do and how we do it? You may not want to hear it, but it's being done on your behalf, so maybe you ought to weigh in. Maybe you ought to be aware. Or is it always going to be a small sampling of Americans who keep up with that stuff?
Well, I think it will end up being a relatively small sampling that certain will keep up with it, or certainly that will cast their vote for senator or representative or president on the basis of those sorts of considerations as opposed to other ones. But this is why we have a Congress. We don't have direct democracy in the United States where we go and say, should we join NATO? Let's take a vote. Or, you know, should we invade Iraq? Let's take a vote. We have elected representatives who are supposed to study these issues, educate themselves, and then make decisions on our behalf. I hate to keep going back to the Congress, but, you know, I spent time there. I was privileged to spend 5 years working as a foreign policy advisor to Senator John McCain. And in that time, we took more than 10 trips to Iraq, and we went back and forth to Afghanistan over and over and over again and so forth. There was no political payoff in that. If anything, it hurt him and other supporters of the surge in Iraq and so forth. But there were a number of senators who thought that that was part of their job, that they had a responsibility to fulfill on behalf of the American people and their constituents, and also, frankly, on behalf of the military if things are not going to go well. And that is – it's almost a spirit of responsibility that I would love to see some members of Congress get more toward, rather than try to generate a national-level popular debate on every single one of our deployments around the world.
You heard Admiral Stavridis that the public's attention is attracted when – sadly, people are coming home to the United States dead. How could that be better? How could we bring people along and get some sort of at least implied consent? I know we don't have a direct democracy, but if people are picking up the paper and finding out that American troops have died in a place where they didn't even know there were American troops, something got disconnected somewhere along the way.
Right. I totally agree with that. And I think, you know, our elected leaders, our president and others don't have to go into every detail of where our troops are deployed and what their activities are. But I think much more information about the wars that the United States is in and how those are going and what the actual objectives of those are. If you stop someone in the street even today and ask them, even in Afghanistan, What are we fighting for? I'm not sure how many people could answer that question very crisply. If you ask them why we're back in Iraq now that it looks like ISIS is mostly defeated, I'm not sure they can answer that question. That's before you get to Niger or you know, working with the French in Mali or anything like that, or the Philippines, places like that. And I think there's a real disconnect in terms of the amount of information and dialogue that our elected leaders have on these life or death issues and the importance of these things.
What worries you? I mean, defense intellectuals looked out from the context of 1950, of 1960, and they thought about what 1980 and 1990 might look like. When we sit here in 2018 and think about 2030 and 2040, what keeps you up at night?
Well, I would say cyber and cybersecurity keep me up because I think our level of preparation is extremely low compared to the level of threat. And I think politically what worries me is a continuation of gridlock in the United States, which leads to isolationism. So one tactical and one strategic thought.
Rich Fontaine?
The thing that worries me is we are very, very used to thinking in defense terms and in alliance terms about specific military threats, now including cyber, but, you know, a Russian invasion of Estonia or a Chinese takeover of the Senkaku Islands or something like this. We are not used at all to thinking about threats generally, but not exclusively through cyber means to our democratic practice here in the United States and in other democracies around the world. And that is an ongoing daily threat. We have to be thinking about a world in which we are already divided, both in terms of our alliances and at home. And we have adversaries that believe the more divided we are and the more at each other's throats they can put us, the less able we will be to project power and therefore less of a threat to them. So they will be actively involved in trying to push distrust and division in the United States and attack the roots of our democracy. We don't think about that at all as a NATO issue or as a U.S.-Japan alliance issue or U.S.-ROK or anything like that. And I think we really need to start.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Admiral James Stavridis. He's former NATO Supreme Allied Commander and is now the Dean of the Fletcher School. He was joined by Richard Fontaine, President of the Center for New American Security, CNAS. Ray Suarez moderated this program. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.